It is October the 17th, and we are in Parshas Devarim. We're on page 942, and we're up to Pasuk Tez Zayin, verse 16. We had just discussed how Moshe Rabbeinu had delegated the court system, allowing other people to be the lower courts. And we mentioned last time how this is going to create the backdrop against which we're going to have the Meraglim, the spies, because of the fact that the authority has been diffused and the way that the Jews reacted when Moshe Rabbeinu offered them this option, rather than reacting in a way that would say that they would have preferred Moshe Rabbeinu. Instead, they wanted it very badly, and their intentions were not pure. Their intentions were in order to allow for them being able to possibly manipulate the system. So we're going to read from Tez Zayin from 16, but before that, I want to just point out a few things from the previous psukim, which we did not mention last time. One is that in Pasuk Tezvav in verse 15, it says, "Vayikach es rashei shivteichem." I'm sorry, we're going to go back a little before that. Before we do 15, let's go back a little bit further. Let's go back to to Pasuk Yud Gimel 13. Havu lachem anashim chachamim unevonim viduim l'shivteichem. Give for yourselves. How do they translate that here? They say
provide.
Provide. Okay, provide for you men who are wise. They say distinguished men who are wise, understanding, and well known to your tribes, and I'll appoint them as your heads. Vasimim barashechem. So Chazal Darshan, they say the word va'asimeim, which means I will place them, can also be read va'ashimeim. If you read this sin as a shin, va'ashimeim, so then it would come from the word asham. And asham is a sin. An asham is a sin offering, and it's a sin. So how would this be a sin? Because that when the judges are placed over the Jewish people, they have to be very careful. Because as leaders, as having the power to judge, so then the sins of the Jewish people now are partially blamed on the judges. It means the judges have the power to enforce the law, and they need to do so properly. And if the judges don't enforce the law properly, then they are partially to blame for the breakdown of the Jewish people to keep the Torah properly. So being a judge, it means that a person has some authority, but that authority brings with it much responsibility. And it's something which a person has to be careful of if they have authority, to make sure that they use it to bring the people to Hashem and to the Torah rather than for any other ulterior motives. That's one point. The other point is that here Moshe Rabbeinu said that he used the people that he asked were that they be anashim. Anashim means distinguished people. Chachamim, wise. Nevonim, understanding. A chacham and a nevon are two different types of intelligence, two different types of wisdom. Viduim, and well known to you. Later in Pasuk Tezvav in 15, it says, "Va'ikach es rashei shivteichem." I took the heads of your tribes, anashim, distinguished men, chachamim, who were wise, viduim, and well known. It leaves out nivonim. It leaves out that word, which means understanding. The difference between chachma and navon. Navon is the ability to take the wisdom and to figure things out beyond what you were told. And so to go beyond what you were told using the information you already have and go further with it. Everybody's able to do that to some extent, but what they were looking for were experts in that area. So Chazal tell us that Moshe Rabbeinu did not find judges who met all the criteria that he asked for. He asked for those four attributes, Anashim, which would be distinguished men, Chachamim would be wise men, those he found, and Viduim, and known to you, well, known entities, he found those. He did not find Nivonim, he did not find those who had this, possessed this attribute of understanding. But the truth is, there's more than that, that he didn't find. In Parashas Yisro, if you want, you can hold the place here, I can read it to you if you'd like, but if you'd like to look back in Parashas Yisro, that will be on page... On page 398, when Yisro was making the suggestion to Moshe Rabbeinu to delegate the job of the courts, meaning not to delegate it completely, but at least the lower courts should be delegated. So he also listed attributes that were necessary for the judges. And in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, verse 21, on page 398, it says, "Ve'atasa chazem mikol ha'am, you will see from all the nation, anshei chayo, men of valor," which is the same thing as anashim that we have with us. So that would be distinguished men. But here he lists three other attributes. Yirei Elokim, those who fear God, anshei emes, men of truth, sonei vatsa, who detest money. That doesn't mean that they throw their money away. It means they don't fight for money. They're willing to give up rather than get into a fight over money. Those three attributes also Moshe Rabbeinu did not find. It doesn't mean there weren't anybody in the Jewish people who were Yirei Elokim, fearing God, Anshei Emes, men of truth, Sonei Vatsa, who detest money. There were, but as a package deal to for a judge who would possess all seven attributes, the four listed here, and we have four listed in Devarim as well, but one of them is an overlap. So the three extra ones that are listed in Devarim, he only found three attributes out of seven as a common thread among the judges. All the judges that he found were distinguished, well-known, and wise. But they did not all possess the other four. Some possessed one, some possessed two, some possessed the other one. They could not find, as a common denominator amongst all the judges, all seven attributes. So that means that we're starting really behind the eight ball. We're starting with judges who are unable to meet all the criteria. Now, again, I have to emphasize, we're not talking about small people. We're talking about big people. We're talking about tzaddikim. We're talking about righteous people. People who were certainly interested in doing the right thing. But still, they did not excel in all of the ways that Yisro and Moshe Rabbeinu said it would be necessary to excel to be the right kind of judge. That is to say, then, that when Moshe Rabbeinu offered this idea of delegating the judges, the Jewish people's reaction should have been, this is what we mentioned last week, but this just underscores the point, the reaction should have been, we would prefer to learn from you, Moshe Rabbeinu. That's who we'd prefer to learn from. Now, even if they would have reacted that way, it still might have been appropriate to appoint judges, which was Yisro's idea. But the Jews should not have been so enthusiastic about it. They should have realized this is a downgrade. We're downgrading, and as the Torah says, or as Rashi points out, they weren't against the downgrade, because downgrading also allows for the possibility of manipulating the system. Again, the Jewish people were not sitting there saying, oh, I can't wait to manipulate the system. It wasn't like that, but there was a little bit of a sense of, okay, you know, so if I get into a dispute, I'll be able to get away with something. People felt that there wouldn't be Big Daddy wouldn't be looking over their shoulder all the time. They'd be able to get away with things that they wouldn't have been able to get away with had the judges been on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu all the way through. So this, again, as we've mentioned, and we'll show later on more directly how this works, but this is going to lead to the atmosphere that can allow for the case, the disaster of the spies to take place. Yeah. No question. Okay, fine. So now we move on to the new psukim, the new verses that we're starting with Tezayin 16. Va'atzaves shofteichem, I commanded your judges. Ba'esahi leimor, at that time saying, Shamoa ben acheichem, listen between your brothers, ushvat tem tzedek, and judge righteously, ben ish uvein achiv uvein gero, between a man and between his brother, and between Gero. Now, Gero, what does Gero? Literally means his ger. But it does not mean his convert. That's not what it means, even though a ger means a convert. So, it could mean between man and his brother and the one who is his Baal Din, the litigant who is against him. The one who is, as Chazal say, Oger Olav Dvarim, the one who has words against him. That would be his litigant, the one fighting with him. But another way of understanding it is, Gero is the one who is involved with living space. Meaning, even if the issue is a minor issue, let's say, as the case that Chazal Sei Rashi cites it over here, would be a case where they are dividing up an estate, and it's a question of who gets this oven, and who gets that oven. This is the larger oven, this is the smaller oven, this is the hotter oven, this is the cooler oven. Just dividing up the ovens, which is a fairly minor thing to divide up, even that you need to focus on and make sure to divide up properly. Even if it's a small item, the division has to be done appropriately. I just want to see how they translate it over here in the English. The gero, they translated as? Your litigant. Okay, fine. Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17. Lo sakiru fanim ba'mishpat. Do not show favoritism in judgment. Now you would say, well, that's obvious. If you're a judge and you show favoritism, then you're not judging. So Chazal say this does not mean what it seems to mean. It does not mean that the judge shouldn't play favorites. That's obvious. If he plays favorites, he's not a judge. This means the one who is appointing the judges shouldn't play favorites. Make sure you pick the most qualified judge. Don't pick, if you have a few candidates to be the judge, don't pick the one you like better. Make sure you pick the one who is more qualified. Kakaton kagadol tishma'un. The small case and the big case should be heard equally. It doesn't matter the amount of money that they are fighting over, whether they're fighting over $1 million or they're fighting over $1. It makes no difference. You should judge it the same. It should always be judged the same way. And in addition to that, that a person shouldn't say, well, okay, the Targum here says it a little differently. The Targum Unkel says that you shouldn't say that kakaton kagadol tishmon means a small person and a big person should be heard equally. Small and big here means financially. Don't say that, well, the person is poor, therefore I will lean the judgment in favor of the poor person, because anyway the rich person is obligated to give tzedakah to the poor person. So if they're fighting over some money, I'll make the rich person come out owing the poor person. And what's the difference? He has to support him anyway. So why not have him pay him in judgment? Don't do that. And the other way around, don't say that the rich person, it would be shameful to make him have to pay, and therefore I will make him win the court case, and then I'll tell him privately, you should give tzedakah back to the poor person, because really you should have lost the case, so I'll save his dignity by having him win in public, and then privately I'll tell him, you know, you need to give money back to the poor person. I really lean that in your favor, and you owe him tzedakah and give it back to him. Don't do that either. Don't play games. Be direct, be honest, be straight, and just judge the way it is. If the poor person loses, so be it. If the rich person loses, so be it. That's the way it goes. Lo soguru mipnei ish. Do not be afraid of any man. So that's straightforward. Don't be afraid. Just because the person is a powerful person makes no difference. You need to judge honestly. This can also mean to be ogur also means to hold in something. The language for an olive that has a lot of oil in the olive is called a zayis aguri. It means like full, like bursting with oil. So lo soguru mipnei ish can also mean don't hold your words in because of a man. Don't be afraid of anybody. Say what you need to say. Don't be afraid to have the words cross your lips if they are what needs to be said. Ki hamishpat le'elokim hu, because the judgment is to Hashem. The judgment ultimately is Hashem's judgment. It's not your judgment. If you judge incorrectly, Hashem says, then I'm going to have to correct the matter. If you give the money to the wrong person, I'm going to have to step in and make sure that the money goes back to where it belongs. So don't play games. You need to judge appropriately. V'adavar sheikshem ikem, and the thing that is too difficult for you, says Moshe Rabbeinu, takrivun elai, bring it close to me, ushmativ, and I will hear it. Meaning I will help out. If there is a dispute that you don't know the answer to, then I will help provide the answer for that one. Now, there's something that I'm not finding over here. Just give me one second. There was something I wanted to share with you, and now I'm not remembering where it is in the psukim. Just give me one second. Right. When it said, kakaton kagadol tishma'un, then you should hear the small case and the big case the same, meaning whether it's $1 million, whether it's $1 makes no difference. There, the issue is what order you're going to hear the cases. Don't order the cases, the daily caseload, by what you think is the most important judgment. Well, this is $1 million dispute. That goes first. This is $1 dispute. Okay, that gets pushed to the late afternoon. That's not the way it works. We do it in order, and even if the $1 one is the first thing on the agenda, then that's what goes first, and that has to be dealt with first. When Moshe Rabbeinu here says, this is a side point, v'adavar sheyikshem yikem takrivun elai ushmativ, that which is too difficult for you, bring close to me and I will hear it. Now remember, Moshe Rabbeinu here is recounting what happened in the past. So when he said that back in Parashas Yisro, when he said it, he was punished for this. Because on his level, this was too much credit for himself. Before we accuse Moshe Rabbeinu of arrogance, let's bear in mind the Torah itself tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu is the Anav Mikol Adam, he's the most humble of all men. And if the Torah says it, it means he is the most humble of all men. That means we do not know of any person who is more humble than Moshe Rabbeinu. So we're not dealing here with arrogance. But the Torah still punishes him, Hashem punishes him because of the choice of words. The language of that which is more too difficult for you, you should bring to me and I will hear it, sounds as if Moshe Rabbeinu is promoting himself. Even though of course he was not. We know he was not, because otherwise the Torah wouldn't call him the most humble of all men. So clearly, he was not promoting himself, but the language nevertheless implied that. And he was punished. How was he punished? In that he did not know the law of inheritance. When the daughters of Tzelophchad came with the question of inheritance, which we learned about in Parashas Pinchas, Moshe Rabbeinu did not know the answer. And he had to ask Hashem rather than know it himself. And that was in order to make it clear that Moshe Rabbeinu, as Hashem says, doesn't always know the answer. One more pasuk, Yurchaz 18, Va'atzaveh eschem bo'ei sahi, I commanded you at that time, eis kolad dvar masher ta'asun, all the things that you should do. Now that's very general. What does that mean? I commanded you, meaning the judges, all the things that you should do. So Chazal tell us, this refers to the 10 differences between monetary cases and capital crimes. A judge judges everything. A judge doesn't just judge monetary cases. A judge will judge capital crimes as well. We do not differentiate in Torah law between a criminal case and a civil case. It's all the same. It's the entire discussion of law is whether a person is keeping the Torah or not, or how to keep the Torah. If you and I get into a dispute over $100, and the question is, do I owe you $100, or do you owe me $100, or do we owe each other nothing? What we're asking is, as we pointed out last week, what does the Torah say? How do we keep the Torah? If the result of the court case is that I owe you $100, we are both keeping the Torah by my paying you and you accepting the $100. Because that's what the Torah says. It's all quote-unquote criminal. We're all quote-unquote civil. It's not criminal or civil. It's neither one. We don't differentiate. It's not the state against the person for the criminal charge and the individual against the individual for the money, for the suing of the person. There's no such thing in Torah law. In Torah law, it's all Torah. It's all about Torah. That we pointed out last week when we were discussing how it's about learning Torah. The Jews should have said, Moshe Rabbeinu, we'd rather learn from you than from other people. Learn? Who's talking about learning? We're talking about court cases. But a court case is learning, because why are we going to court? We're going to court because we don't know what the Torah says about our dispute. I think that you owe me money, you think I owe you money, and our question is, what does the Torah say? And that's all that matters. It's not a question of who wins and who loses. It's about keeping the Torah. And so these judges are being appointed to do what? To help the people understand what the Torah says. And therefore, it makes no difference if it's a capital crime, if it's a corporal crime, if it's a dispute over money. It's all the same. It's all about what does the Torah say. And that's why all these laws are here. One of the things that we needed to explain was, why do we have all of these laws here about the judges when Moshe Rabbeinu is about to criticize the people for the sin of the spies? So we talked about how he's delegated authority in a way that has brought down the Torah a little bit, as we've already talked about. We'll talk about it more presently. But why get into the nitty-gritty of the laws of judges? This could have been discussed in Parashas Yisro when we were first introduced to the lower courts and higher courts. So why over here about, don't be afraid of saying the right thing, make sure the smaller cases, the bigger cases are equal, make sure that you appoint proper judges. Why is that all over here now? And especially the differences between monetary law and court and capital crime. Why is that here? The answer is because as long as the judges were seeing their role as what does the Torah say? That's what we're here for. We're not here for winners and losers. We're here for how does the Torah want this to go? So that may have prevented the Meraglim. It prevented the spies. As soon as Moshe Rabbeinu realized that the people wanted this authority, his authority being diffused, as soon as he realized that, so he felt it was important that whichever judges actually were sitting in court would make sure that it was all about what is the emes, what does the Torah want. And therefore, these laws are emphasized here that the point is not winners and losers, not trying to, you know, beat the system so that I can win, but rather, what does the Torah want? In a secular law system, so there's people, it's all about winning and losing. And people want to beat the system. If I have a dispute with money over you, I want to win. Now, people beat the system illegally and legally. So I can talk about trying to win illegally by bribing the judge or something like that, or presenting false information or false evidence. That's one way of illegally winning. But even legally, I want the money. So if I can figure out a loophole in the law that will allow me to keep the money, I get the money. So I win. Wonderful. So I get more money. It's a winning and losing situation. That is not what a din Torah is meant to be. It's not meant to be winning and losing. It's meant to be, what does the Torah say on this case? And if I manage to work the system in my favor, whether it's honestly or dishonestly, whether it's dishonestly that I present false information or lie or whatever it is, or even honestly that somehow I'm able to figure out how to like work around the system, that's not necessarily the right thing. And if it's the wrong thing, I can win down here and lose upstairs. And that doesn't help me. It doesn't help anybody. And the point of the court system is to win upstairs. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu says this is what it should be. What are the 10 differences between monetary law and capital crime? So I'd like to digress for a few moments and go through the 10 differences so that we can understand it. It is a Mishnah in Maseches Sanhedrin on Daf Lamed Beis Amud Aleph. It's 32a. And the Mishnah lists the 10 differences between monetary law and capital crime. Capital crime means someone accused of a capital crime and we're trying him for a capital crime. He may be innocent, but that would be a capital crime. So what are the differences between the two? So I will go through them now. The way the Mishnah begins is that in terms of cross-examining the witnesses, it's the same. There's no difference between a capital crime or a monetary dispute. We're going to cross-examine people the same way. But we have 10 major differences. So what are they? Let me just find the beginning over here. First of all, the Mishnah says that monetary law is judged with 3 judges. A court of 3 judges is all you need for a monetary dispute. How many judges do you need for a capital crime? Anybody know? 23. You need 23 judges for a capital crime. There's 3 types of courts in 3 main types of courts. There's some, there are very, very rare cases where there's other numbers, but it's either 3, 23, or 71. 71 is for much bigger types of things, but a typical capital crime would be 23 judges. A typical monetary dispute is 3 judges. That's number one. So the amount of judges is number one. The Mishnah says that when you begin the discussion of a monetary dispute, and you're gonna, now usually, the way I presented it was, I say that you owe me money and you say I owe you money. It doesn't usually work that way. Usually it's, I say you owe me money and you say I don't. Right? So the winning and losing is whether you're gonna pay or not pay. Usually it's not who's gonna pay who. So, when discussing a monetary dispute, and we're gonna start introducing evidence and start making a discussion about it, it doesn't matter how you start. Meaning, as the judges begin their deliberation about the case, they can start with this, trying to defend the side that the person owes the money, or they can start by defending the side that the person doesn't owe the money. Doesn't matter how they begin their deliberation. But when it comes to a capital crime, we always start with zechus. We always start by defending the defendant. By trying to defend the side that he is not liable for execution. And then we move to the other side. So we want to start the discussion on the side of Zechus, on the side that the person should be exonerated and not be executed. That's number two. Number three, that when you have a monetary dispute, so it's a simple majority decides the case. So you have 3 judges, and 2 judges rule in favor of one person, and 1 judge rules in favor of the other person, then it's 2-1, and the one who has the 2 judges wins. In the event that they don't know, So we'll add more judges. That's what's going to happen if they don't know the, if the three judges get stuck, they don't know the answer, they'll bring in more judges. But with, if it's a, it's a simple majority, 2-1 wins the court case. Whether it's in favor of the one who's demanding the money or in favor of the one who's saying they don't know the money, either way. When it comes to a capital crime, so if it is in favor of the defendant, then it's a simple majority. So it's 23 judges. 12 say that he is putter. 11 say he is chayev. So then 12-11 he wins and he is not executed. However, in order to execute, the majority has to be at least 2, which is really 3. So it's, if you have 23 judges and the have 13 who say that he needs to be executed and 10 say no, then he's executed. It's 13-10. But if it's 12-11 in favor of execution, we do not execute. Now, I've mentioned this to you before. You can't just let him off the hook if it's 12-11 in favor of execution, because it's still the majority is saying that he should be executed. So you can't kill him because you don't have more than a one-person majority. But you can't let him off the hook either because you don't have the majority saying that he is punter. So what do you do in that case? So what you do in that case is you add more judges. It's 12-11 in favor of execution. You add 2 more judges and you keep adding judges until you either have a simple majority in favor of exonerating him or you have more than a simple majority in favor of execution. That's what happens. But you can't execute based on a one judge majority. That's okay. That was number 3. That was the third difference. A fourth difference is that, what happens if they finish the court case, so the gavel comes down, and then new evidence is discovered? So what happens then? So with monetary law, we retry the case. If it's legitimately new evidence, new witnesses come, there's always a suspicion. It looks kind of funny. Why weren't they here before? So they will vet that to make sure that there was a reason why this evidence wasn't introduced before, but they will reopen the case with new evidence. With a capital crime, we will only reopen the case if the original ruling was for execution. If the original ruling was for execution, we will reopen the case to try to exonerate. But if the original ruling was to say that he is putter, he is not executed, we will not reopen the case even with new evidence. Then the case is just dropped. Once we rule that he is off the hook, then we do not reopen the case. So that is a fourth difference between monetary law and dine nefashos and a capital crime. That was number 4. Number 5. when they deliberate, so what then happens is we then ask the judges for their opinion. And the judges will weigh in. So a judge will say, you know, I believe that he is chayev, I believe he is pater. They'll go back and forth. And the court case isn't over yet. They're kind of putting out their first opinion. So once they put out their first opinion, they can debate back and forth. And they'll each try to convince the other ones. So the ones who say that that the person owes the money will try to convince the ones who say that he doesn't owe the money why they feel he does owe the money. The ones who say he doesn't owe the money will try to defend their position of why he doesn't owe the money. Same thing with the capital crime. They'll debate back and forth. What if one of the judges decides, you know what? I want to change my opinion. Sounds good the other way. So we don't allow in a capital crime those who are arguing in favor of exonerating him, we don't allow them to change their opinion during the deliberation process. During the time of deliberation, they cannot change their side. They have to defend the side that they originally believed in, which is that he is putter. If the judge honestly feels he made a mistake and would like to switch and say that he actually believes the person needs to be executed, we will only allow that at the very end of the case. So at the very end, when they're actually taking the final vote, if at that point the judge says, you know what, I was wrong, I really firmly believe that he is chayiv misa, that he needs to be executed, we will allow the judge to change their opinion then, because we can't have him lie. I mean, if he really believes that he's chayiv, we can't let him say pater. But during the deliberation time, once the judge is defending this person, he cannot switch sides and start and try to prove that he is guilty. So that's another difference.
Can he stay quiet?
He could stay quiet. The question is, could he stay quiet? In theory, he could stay quiet, except that they are going back and forth, and his opinion is going to be asked. So he would have to weigh in. You know how it is, if anybody's been on a debating team, you can defend, you can pick a side to defend, even if though you know that both sides have merit. Clearly, if we're talking about an argument between judges, it means that there's room to defend either side. So he needs to stay with the side of zechus, of merit, if that's where he started, until the very end of the case. There are other people in the courtroom besides the judges. There are other people there. It's not a private affair, but especially there are talmidim. There are students who are studying to be judges who are in the courtroom. That's the best way to learn, is watch the proceedings and see the deliberation. So what happens if there's a student who feels that he has something to add that was overlooked by the judges? That can happen. We know that that certainly can happen. So is the student allowed to speak up? So in a monetary case, by all means, the student can speak up. In a capital crime, a student may only speak up in favor of innocence, not in favor of guilt. The student may not speak up. Even if the student thinks they've thought of something that the judges overlooked, he may not speak up for guilt in a capital crime. The way that all judgments, this is another difference, all court cases need to be done during the day. We do not judge at night. We only judge during the day. That's the rule. We judge during the day. Now, monetary law, all court cases begin during the day. When they, let's say that the case drags on, and now the sun goes down, we can complete the discussion after sunset. So even though the court case has to start during the day, we started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but then the sun went down, we continue our discussion until we resolve it. With a capital crime, the rule is you need halanas, is it halanas hadin? I forget the exact language. You have to sleep on it. Now, this is a tough thing. The judges are dealing with a person's life. So they debate it throughout the day, and now the sun goes down. They are required to adjourn and sleep on it and get back together the next morning. During that time when they adjourn, they are not allowed to indulge in eating and drinking. They can have a little bit to eat, a little bit to drink, just so they're not starving and they're not, not thirsty, but they're not allowed to indulge. They're not allowed to sleep the night away. They get together, they talk, they debate, they think about it. The idea is that the judges needs to play on their minds. They need to feel very good about this, because they're going to put someone to death. They need to know, they're going to have to live with themselves. And we make them live with themselves overnight. And then the next morning, they get back together and then vote. We don't let them vote until the next morning. They must sleep on it so that the judges really think this through before they actually put someone to death. That's also another difference between monetary law and capital crime.
Prince,
yes?
At that point, that night, can they... Like you said, the judge couldn't switch sides during deliberation. Can they do it when
Okay, the question is, when we mentioned that the judge can't switch sides during deliberation, but they could for the final vote. What about overnight? I don't know the answer. My impression is that he cannot switch sides even overnight, assuming that he's defending them, assuming he's arguing for innocence. But I don't know because it's not an official proceeding. It's kind of like, you know, they're getting together in pairs and, you know, and just discussing. So I'm not sure at that point what if there are any rules governing what side you defend.
And what if you have the case where you have to add more judges? At that point, can they switch?
Okay, question is, if you're adding more judges, could they switch? They can switch again when you make a final vote. Yeah, the final vote, they can switch. Yeah. Yeah. I'll discuss that a little bit more as soon as we get through the all 10 things. I'll discuss that point. That is I think the most confusing thing. People don't realize exactly how that works. We'll talk about that a little bit. Another difference, which is very similar to the one we just said, which is can you complete the judgment the same day? Meaning, I mentioned before, what if you get to the nighttime, you're not done yet? So for monetary law, you just go into the night. For capital crime, you have to go to the next day. You can't go into the night. Can you just complete it the same day? Let's say we're done. We've finished our deliberation and the sun is still up. Can we just rule? So in a monetary law, you can. You don't have to go into the night. You can just finish your ruling right then. For a capital crime, if your vote is that he's innocent, you can complete it right away. Just stop right there. If it's for guilt, then you have to go overnight. You cannot rule right then. You have to wait till overnight.
But how do you know?
You take a vote at the, if they say we're done.
Yeah.
And if they're not done, you wait till the next morning. If they say we're done, then you take a vote. And if the vote is in favor of execution, then we say, okay, we're not ruling right now. We're waiting until tomorrow morning. Sleep on it. Right. That's right. Okay. It is for this reason that you can't judge, you can't start a capital crime case on Friday or Erev Yontif, because you can't judge on Shabbos and Yontif. So since what would end up happening is we'd have to push it off to the next morning, and you can't judge the next morning, which means you have to wait two mornings. That we don't do. That would be inoy hadin. That would be affliction of judgment. That would not be appropriate. We do not delay judgment, meaning that once they're ready to judge, assuming we've completed all the rules here, they judge immediately. And there's no such thing as death row. You don't have a person waiting for a long period of time. Once the judgment is execution, the person is executed that day. There's no waiting around after that. And if they waited overnight to make sure they're sleeping on it, and we already searched out evidence, then the court case may take longer than a day because they may need to gather evidence. But once the court case is over and they've ruled for execution, we do not delay. It's the same day. We don't delay with execution. Having a person sitting around waiting to die is considered inui hadin. That's affliction of judgment. We don't do that. With monetary law, so when you ask the judges for their opinion at the end and you're voting, so you start with the most respected judge, the greatest one, and then you ask everybody their opinion. People know they can disagree. I mean, they've disagreed the entire time. They've been deliberating. But the first one, the we'll call him the chief judge. It's not the chief justice because you have many courts. But the chief judge gives his opinion first, and then the other ones give their opinion. When it comes to dine nefashos, when it comes to capital crime, you do not begin with the chief judge because we don't want to intimidate the lower judges. We want them to feel they can speak their mind. With a monetary case, they're less likely to be intimidated because the stakes aren't so high. So, okay, so I know that he's a bigger Torah scholar than I am, but I also have my opinion. He feels this way, I feel that way. All right. I'm not intimidated to say something. But with a capital crime, and he's you know, he's saying innocent. I'm not going to say guilty if he's innocent. And if he says guilty, I'm going to say, wow, he really believes it so much he says guilty. I should say innocent. So it's going to intimidate me. So therefore we don't start with the top judge. We start with the lower judges. And finally, the last difference is that, all judges, assuming that they have the correct scholarship, all judges are fit to judge a monetary case, but a capital crime can only be done by those who are, now this is, those who are, the way the Mishnah says it is, who are able to marry a Kohen, which is going to be the Miuchasim, those who can trace their lineage back. Now this is not something, everything else until now was logical, meaning it was based on, we're trying to make it easier to find innocence than guilt in a capital crime. This is based on a pasuk that when it comes to a capital crime, that the judges have to be miuchasim, that they have a lineage that is traceable and that is known not to have any issues with it. So whatever that means, and I don't remember exactly how we come out with that, exactly who is excluded and who is included, there's a whole discussion in the Gemara. What does that mean? Who are we excluding from being a capital crime judge? So whatever that is, it is. But that's not really in the same type of category as the other ones that we mentioned. Now to clarify this issue of adding judges, we discussed this actually not long ago, but let's go through it anyway because it's a confusing thing to people. So let's go through just to talk it out how that works. So we have 23 judges, and of the 23 judges, 12 ruled in favor of guilt and 11 ruled in favor of innocence. And it's a capital crime. We cannot put him to death on a 12-11 vote, but we can't let him off either. So, because the majority said to put him to death, so we can't let him off free. So what we do is we add 2 judges. Now we have 25. So with those 25, we now take another vote. After they deliberate, we take another vote. So if those 2, assuming the 12 and 11 remained the same as before, 12 were voting for guilt and 11 for innocence, those new 2 people, if they go to either side, in other words, if they both go for innocence or they both go for guilt, then we will be able to rule. Because if they both go for innocence, we've gone from 12 in favor of guilt and 11 in favor of innocence, now we have 13 for innocent and 12 for guilt. That's a simple majority. He's off the hook. On the other hand, if both go towards guilt, it used to be 12 for guilt and 11 for innocence, we now have 14 for guilt and 11 for innocence. Okay, again, now we have more than a one-man majority and we can put him to death. If they split, so we've gone from 12 in favor of guilt and 11 in favor of innocence, and now we have 13 for guilt and 12 for innocence, we're in the same boat. We haven't solved the problem. So we add 2 more judges and we do the same thing and they deliberate again. And again, if we end up with either a simple majority in favor of innocence, then he's innocent. If we end up with more than a one-man majority in favor of guilt, then he's guilty. And if we end up again with a one-man majority in favor of guilt, we add 2 more judges. And we keep doing that as long as each judge goes in either direction, or, you know, because the ones who voted before could change their minds in the final vote. But as long as we continually end up with a one-man majority in favor of guilt, then we just keep adding 2 judges. So we started with 23, you go to 25, 27, 29, 31, always an odd number, so that you'll have a majority in one way or the other. And you keep doing that until you get to 71. So at 71, now the worst thing that could happen is you'll end up with 36 in favor of guilt and 35 in favor of innocence. So again, you're stuck. If you'd end up with 36 to 35 in favor of innocence, then you're good, then he's free. If you end up with 37 to 34 in favor of guilt, then he's put to death. But if you end up with 36 to 35 in favor of guilt, what do? You can't add more judges. Once you get to 71, you're stuck. Now this is a highly unlikely scenario that the judges keep on you know, one going to one side, one to the other side, but it could happen. So if that happens, then the 36 and the 35 simply debate. They debate and debate and debate until someone changes their mind. And that's all we can do. We can't do anything else at that point other than debate until someone changes their mind. And then you'll either get 36, 35 in favor of innocence, or 37, 34 in favor of guilt. This adding of judges can also happen if one or more of the judges says, I don't know, and I'm unwilling to vote, because I really don't know. Remember, here, the issue is, what does the Torah say? A judge has the right to say, I simply don't know the answer. I'm not schooled enough to know. I'm simply deficient in my knowledge. I thought I'd be able to try this case, but I really don't know. So, in that case, you're short a judge. Now, being short a judge does not undermine the whole thing if you have a majority in one direction. So let's say you had 23 judges, and one judge says, I don't know. That leaves 24 judges. So if they're 12 to 12, then you obviously can't rule. But if they're 12, if you end up with 13 to 11, in either direction, you're okay, because then you have a two-man majority, either in favor of guilt or innocence. If you end up with 12 to 12, you have to add more judges. And that's what we'll do. Again, we'll add judges, we'll always add judges until you get to 71. Once you get to 71, then we can't add judges anymore, and at that point they'll have to fight it out, and someone has to win, someone has to convince the other one. But again, it's a highly unlikely situation. Yeah?
When they add more judges, and then to deliberate, do they wait another night?
Okay, the question is, when they add more judges and deliberate, do they wait another night? It seems that they would wait another night if it was in favor of guilt.
Right.
Yeah, if it was in favor of guilt. If it wasn't in favor of guilt, then they can just rule right then.
So but they could just keep going, add another night.
Keep adding, right. It's not considered inui hadin. Inui hadin means affliction of judgment. It's not considered inui hadin until the gavel comes down. As long as the court case could go on for days,
right.
And that's not because then the defendant does not yet see, for lack of a better, for just the noose around his neck, even though we don't kill that way. But I'm just saying, he doesn't see his death right in front of him because he still might be innocent. But once it comes down and he is going to be put to death, then we don't wait. Then we consider that to be cruel and unusual punishment for him to wait around to die. So we don't do that. Okay, so those are some of the laws of judges, and that Moshe Rabbeinu tells us. And what that brings us to over here is that, as I mentioned, that now we are going to move forward to the actual case of the spies, and this is going to be the backdrop against which the spies is going to happen. And what our problem is that not only has the authority of Moshe Rabbeinu been delegated, but the people were not pure, did not have pure motives for delegating Moshe Rabbeinu's authority. And that is going to lead to, it's not going to directly lead to the spies, but when the spies happen, the atmosphere is going to be one that will lend itself to problems rather than lend itself to solving the issue. Instead, it's going to exacerbate the issue. That's what we're leading up to. So we're going to stop here for tonight. So we are up to Pasuk Yutes, verse 19, where next week, Mirtz Hashem, we'll continue there and move on with the actual recounting of the story of the spies. Thank you. Oh, there's a question. Yes, after what?
After Moshe Rabbeinu's time. Who appointed the
judges? After Moshe Rabbeinu's time, who appointed the judges? That's the question. So that's even with Moshe Rabbeinu, he asked the various tribes to present candidates because he didn't know everybody. That's why it says viduim, those who you know of, that you're aware of in your communities. So it just seems like the various leaders of the various communities suggested people for the positions. Okay.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.